It's more like, no, I remember on that day, that disc was incredible. Welcome to Clocker Counter. I'm James Wiseman, and with me is Ryan Young. So today we have to start on a little bit of a somber note, which is that this week, Tati Brodeur passed doing what he loved to do most, which is jamming on the beach in South Carolina. I've been really touched by the outpouring of love and feeling towards Tati and his huge impact in our sport. And so we didn't want to start the podcast without saying a little bit more about him. But I was thinking with what happened, how much Tati was involved in my early freestyle days. So I think if you made a list of people who have been to tournaments with me, he has to be in the top 10. Because I think he's probably been to most American freestyle tournaments, the Virginias, the Jam.
Sunbreak.
I think, Sunbreak. I think he's probably been to, he came to the Austin tournaments. He might have even gone to one or two of the Colorado events. I'm sure he's gone to Beach Dialers. So he was really a big supporter and mainstay of freestyle in the U.S. But he's also one of the Americans who made a huge effort to go out to the European events, which I really appreciate when kind of the older generation freestylers make that effort. And I'm sure it was a, you know, time and financial burden for him, which shows how important it was for him to go out there and show his support for the new generation of freestylers. A couple other kind of like personal notes for me. I remember going to visit him in Boston when I was living in New York very early in my freestyle career, I think in like my first year or two, and playing on Newport Beach with him and Pops. And one very specific memory I have is one of my best friends from college, Shaylin, who's kind of the furthest thing from a freestyle you could imagine. We went out and jammed with Tati, and Tati must have spent an hour getting him to catch a scarecrow. And he did finally get one. But Tati, as anyone who spent any amount of time with him would know, he was incredibly encouraging, incredibly supportive. And I was kind of in that situation where I was like, boy, I hope he doesn't feel pressure, like he has to keep trying to help him catch a scarecrow, where you like you kind of feel responsible for your friend. But Tati was just completely undeterred and just kept going and going and going. And I always appreciated that about him. A few other things about Tati. Obviously, one of the pioneers of freestyle videos. I think as long as I've been playing, he's had his massive tutorial series on YouTube. Is that the same for you?
Yeah.
I'm sure I've seen every single one of those at one point or another. I learned a lot about rolling and like lots of kind of like funky tricks. I don't even think I know how to do anymore from watching those videos. So those were a huge impact for me. Another little side note is I was looking for videos of Tati just to kind of, you know, feel my feelings. And he's posted like 10 or 15 videos in the last couple of weeks of just like old tournament footage, but also like a jam with Pops. And this is another sad element of this. But then I went on YouTube and I just filtered freestyle frisbee videos for the last few months. And, you know, there's like 1,000 videos for me. Sorry. But then a bunch of the other ones are from Tati. So I feel like in a way that I didn't expect, we lost a big content producer in our sport and someone who was clearly doing the work to preserve some old freestyle footage. So I really hope that we can, you know, talk to his wife, Sam, and see if we can kind of get some of that footage he might have been sitting on and get it out there back in the world. You and I just got to spend a whole weekend with him in Frisbeer, which was kind of unexpected. I think we probably had 3 or 4 dinners with him sitting across from us. It was really kind of shocking that it happened so suddenly. And I guess the last thing I can think of is one of my fondest memories is watching Celtics playoff basketball with him at the Jammers every year because the Celtics have been good and he was a huge Celtics fan and he's got that super strong Boston accent. And I feel like I followed the Celtics a lot more closely than I would have otherwise simply because I enjoyed whenever I saw Toddy getting to kind of just shoot the shit with him about basketball. So, yeah, he will be deeply, deeply missed. And I think anyone who's been looking at the outpouring on social media will feel the same way. Any parting thoughts on that, Ryan?
No, that was well said.
Yeah, I don't know if there's really any good way to say it or talk about it. But he really had a big impact on the sport. And I think we all feel it. And if there's anyone who wants to talk about it, feel free to give me a call. I'm happy to be a listening ear for somebody, because I know when things like this happen, a lot of times it's the people closest to Toddy that are suffering the most. So, you know, we're here. There's a big community of people. We're all mourning, and I'm sure we'd, you know, love to be there. So no good way to transition from that, but we do have some listener questions we wanted to go through. Just got to keep spreading the jam, just like Toddy would want us. So Ryan, I believe you have the first listener question. I don't know anything about it except that maybe it has something to do with disc.
Yep. Okay. So my question is, how much do you think the disc matters? So like, maybe you can put it in terms of years of practice or how good the wind is that day, but like everything about the disc, like the color, how slick it is, the state of break-in.
Is 5 years not enough? I think the disc, it can be easily 50 or 70%. Like that's how much it can make or break your jam, right?
Yep. Okay, I have a follow-up question. Just like, what do you think the variance of it? So like, you're comparing like the best disc possible to like the worst disc possible, but like, where is the average? Is it like in the middle of those two, or is it like closer to the better side?
No, it's closer to the bottom 20%. Okay. Do you agree with that?
I agree as well.
Yeah. Here's how important it is. I can, just like you remember Magic jams, I remember Magic discs, and not just like, oh, that was a disc that was really good for a long time. It's more like, no, I remember on that day, that disc was incredible. I can, and there are consistent themes when I think of these memories. Pavel is in a lot of them. Tom Leitner is in a lot of them. They're like, Toddy Brodeur is in a lot of them. There are certain people that have disc preparation techniques that are somehow superior and work. But I think there's so many factors that have to come together that make it really rare. You have to have the right year and model. So like as a starting like point, wine. You need like a 2008 Prague Frisbeer disc like that. You're now halfway there. Then it has to be the right level of broken in. You certainly need the kind of film layer on top of the disc to have been worn down or sanded down. It needs to have been properly cleaned, and then it needs to have been properly slick. Then you need to have right temperature, humidity, and other conditions. You have to be in a environment that doesn't have too much dust, dirt, or sand. But when all the factors come together, like I don't think Will has ever played with a good disc in his life, because I don't remember, it's been years since I've had a jam with like a truly good disc. I feel like maybe you've had a couple potlatch discs.
Those are good, yeah.
Yeah, I've had a couple like tournament jams with you where you had a really good disc, but we've always been somewhere where I feel like the conditions quickly put an end to it. But it doesn't surprise, like when you asked that question, I was answering it, I had a feeling you were going to come out the same way. But I have a feeling people are going to be surprised at my analysis here.
I think it's like when you live, you just get used to what you live in currently. So like maybe a whole community never played with a good disc, and so they don't know any better is what's happening right now.
There's just whole categories of things that I can only do with a good disc. Like it's so important, and I've kind of given up on having a good disc anymore because I'm out of plastic that is the vintage year, which I do think is sort of 50% of the battle.
I was actually going to say exactly the opposite, where if you don't have a good disc, preparation can make a big difference. Like, I think you can always get a yellow disc. So that's a big part of it. It's like, there's no problem getting a yellow disc.
No, you can't always get a yellow disc. I don't think there are hardly any yellow old disc left. There's only new yellow disc.
But
you know why? Because I bought all the old yellow disc. I've cornered the market. But I've used most of them.
I see. But even the new, actually, I haven't prepared a new yellow disc. I've only played with other people's new yellow plastic. Mm-hmm. And after you told me, Will said he thinks it's better. I think, like, revisionist history, I think it actually is quite good. I think you just need a yellow disc regardless of the year. Just except for 2010. That was a terrible year of discs.
2010. And that's when I just started. That people were literally giving them away because that was a year where I was like, does anyone have any discs that I can use to give away? And I got hundreds of discs. People were like, we don't want them. Take them. The new plastic is interesting. I played with someone's new plastic at some event recently. I feel like it was Worlds or maybe it was Frisbeer, but I think it was longer ago than that. And it was the first time I was like, okay, this is a really good disc. And not like 2008 Pavel Prague disc, but it was really good. And it kind of gave me hope. And I also think that's interesting is, what if the yellow disc we've used so far that are new are 2010 discs?
That's what I'm hoping as well.
We don't really know if it was a good year or a bad year for the new plastic yet. And time will tell what the variance is in the new plastic, because the variance is extremely high in old plastic. And frankly, I always thought it was a big business problem, because one thing that always kept me from buying custom discs, which I think I only did one time other than for tournaments, was I was nervous I'd get a bad batch. So if I bought 200 and they were 2010 discs, that would be a catastrophic economic loss.
Yeah.
But on prep, it's interesting because there's times where I think I think I go through phases where I realize that I'm being too lazy about my disc. I need to take all proper precautions and have a great disc ready at all times. And then I'll do everything I know that you can do to make a disc better. And it's not worth it because either the disc gets ruined very quickly by the conditions, or it's not good enough to justify the effort that went into fixing it up.
How long does it take you to prep a brand new disc?
Brand new? I feel like if you were doing it right, it would take at least 20 minutes.
Wow. Okay, that's significantly longer than I've seen you prepare a disc.
Yeah, but if because this happens sometimes. Like, let's say Will is coming over and we want to jam and we want to make like the sickest study tape. And all I have is new plastic, which happens more often than you think. And so I need to emergency prepare a disc. I have to take it out. I have to sand it for a long time. So I have to find my sandpaper. I got to wet the disc, wet the sandpaper. I got to sand for at least 5 or 10 minutes. And that's just on my, what would you call it? Like my lower grit sandpaper, my coarser sandpaper. And that's just to get the film off. So let's say we're at like a 400, 600 grit sandpaper, maybe like 800 is like good enough. 400 might be too low. So you sand it off. It's hard. You got to get that edge down, or the rim is super hard to get sanded properly.
Are you talking like the edge where it's sharp, or like in the corner?
In the, like, if you imagine sticking your thumb into the rim of the disc, okay, or where your disc is, where your thumb is for an overhand wrist flip.
Okay.
So you got to really do that. And then you got to wash it again. You got to wash the disc. Now you got to get soap and water involved and really scrub it out. Then you got to go to a less coarse grit, like 1,000 grit. And if you're really doing it properly, you probably have to do three levels, like 600, 1,000, 1,500-ish or so. And then you got to dry it out. Then you got to slick it. And if you really wanted to prepare it, you probably want to slick it, take a dry, super absorbent cloth, de-slick it, and then re-slick it. And I don't know why that last step makes sense to me, but I'm telling you it does. Like, there's something about the super fresh lick that's just not quite right. It's going to be like over slicked because you needed to get a baseline level of slickness, dry that all out, okay, and then slick it like a normal
I can make up a reason that Jeff makes sense, which is okay, the first time you put the slick on, it absorbs. It's the first time slick has touched that plastic and it changes the chemical makeup. And then you got to reapply slick so you get like that same reaction for real this time, because the first time was just to like get that chemical right. It's like priming wood. It like absorbs the first layer of paint you paint on, so it doesn't really do anything.
So I'm partially exaggerating my prep work here, but I do worry that if we were like a 16th century podcast, this would be us being like, well, you put the leeches on to get the dirty blood out and that's what makes the cancer go away. Like we have no idea really what we're talking about in terms of like what happens chemically, but in my gut, those things seem to matter. But you know what? I'd actually even add another step a little bit controversially, but I think if you were really serious, once you finish sanding and drying, I would take a dry cloth and I would basically sand it with the cloth and just use like friction and heat to kind of like get like a little extra polish on it. And then I would do my double slicking technique.
I'm surprised you wanted so, or you spend so much effort getting it as smooth as possible.
Well, let me pause on that, okay, because I do think there's an element of, it's like take a car tire. If you wanted to maximize the friction between the tire and the road in pristine conditions, you would have no tread, like an F1 tire, right? Mm-hmm. But we have treads on our tire because it's not always pristine conditions. There's rain and there's dirt and there's whatever else. So you need the tread to kind of like filter through that so that the rubber can actually kind of like make contact with the road. And what does that mean? I don't know. I'm just blithering. But I do have this like certain tension with perfect slickness or perfect smoothness is probably just creating more surface area that would on your nail, which would slow down the disc. And so maybe you want it to be a little bit rougher on the bottom.
That's
also be why when you've like really worn a disc down by plane and like the noisy disc is often the best disc. So like I do believe there's truth to that. But I think for the first round, it's so hard to get the film off that you go for smoothness and your nails are going to create the roughness in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Like from plane.
Oh, so I was just going to ask, how long do you think it takes for the disc to break in? So there's like windows for me where it's like, this is a new disc, then it's in its prime, and then it's like too used. Like how long does it take to get to the prime?
That's so hard to guess. I'm guessing it's the prime is between like day 3 and day 10, depending on a million circumstances.
Okay. So it is like in hours of use. That's when it hits its prime.
In hours. Yeah. Maybe hours would be like hour 6 to hour 18.
Okay.
Maybe that's even too big.
You think so? I think it's like 4 to 8. That's my,
if that's short, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's also one of those things, like maybe any product or some disc just are good for me for weeks. And so many other discs are never good. And some discs are good for a couple days. But it's very like, it's an interesting idea because it's something I really track. And I don't think it's intuitive, especially because I usually am carrying around 4 or 5 discs that are visually similar. But it'd be interesting to do a study on the lifespan of a disc, because I think you might learn that discs only last like 10 days on average, or like 10 jams on average. I don't think it's that many.
Yep. I think it is pretty short. That's what I tell people when I'm giving discs away. I'm like, these are like baseballs. You just like throw them into the stands after every play because they don't last very long.
They don't last very long. I burn through so many discs. It's crazy. But the weird thing is I don't have much memory of recycling lots of discs. Like they just like
disappear.
I mean, obviously I give away, you know, at least 100 or 200 discs a year, but it genuinely feels like discs just disappear. I think probably it's because once a disc is past its prime for me, I don't bother trying to track it down at the end of a jam.
Oh.
Like I'm usually leaving the jam early And I'm just like, that disc is gone now. Whoever takes it, it's theirs now.
Yeah. It's... Okay.
All right. Anything else on disc? I don't think so. Dougie says you got to bathe with your disc. And I think there's truth to that.
Like there's a bond.
I think it's mostly because almost no one cleans their disc, and bathing is good. And soaking the disc like that is better than just trying to wash it off. Like soap, water, soak. It's not that easy to soak a disc in, like fully immerse a disc in water with soap. You need a giant bowl to do that. But I think that's the best cleaning technique. And so bathing with it makes sense to me. And I think he's half kidding, but he definitely bathes with his disc. So I do recommend that. I have found that bathing a disc works, as weird as it sounds. And cleanliness is a much bigger factor than people realize. You will find that your disc is covered in dirt. And you had no idea.
Go ahead. Do you slick your disc when it's new and let it marinate?
Only if I've already sanded it.
Yeah. So you, like, you prepare it, you slick it, then you put it back in the bag and then you just like leave it alone for a bit.
Yeah. I kind of believe in marinating it. Okay. I'm not 100% sure, but it's more like my feeling is that when I slick something on the spot that's not very slick, it doesn't work very well. But if a disc comes out that's already slick, it seems to work better.
Yep, I agree. I have like year slick cycle now. So like I'm slicking discs for next year.
But okay, yeah. But it's not that you think it needs a year. It's more like you're preparing your next world's disc.
Yeah,
now.
I'm just doing like batches. But it's nice to have a disc ready to go that's like has that 20 minutes of prep.
That's fair. There's one other aspect that I think is worth mentioning, which is I'm going to put on my witch doctor 16th century medicine man hat. I do think kind of what you were saying earlier, there are kind of a chemical compositional changes that can occur that you can help instigate. So for instance, I found when I was dyeing frisbees that those frisbees were consistently better to play with. Except that they broke way more often. But I could take a bad disc that I thought was too hard and not very fast, boil it as part of the dyeing process. It's a near boil. It's not like a raging boil. It's kind of like a simmer, but it had to be that hot of water for the dye to set. And something about that, like certainly cleaned the disc, maybe boiled off some of the film, which is disgusting to think about, whatever fumes that's just like spouting out into the world. And seemed to change the disc in a way that was positive. Similarly, I've baked frisbees before. You got to go a pretty low temperature because they will melt. I haven't done it in a long time. I think I was doing less than 250 degrees, and that had a similar effect to boiling them. And I do wonder if long-term slicking can make a difference. Sun also makes a difference, but will make your disc super brittle and remove all of its color. Which some people are into that, but it makes your disc very brittle. That's kind of the side effect of it. And then kind of related is, I think the problem with a lot of discs is they're a little bit too heavy and a little bit too hard, and sanding them down a whole bunch improves the situation greatly.
Yep.
So I don't know. We really need like Tom Leitner and Pavel to come on to give us the truth.
I mean, yeah. Maybe we'll just...
I did try buying an orbital sander once and really tried to sand disc, but it was impossible for me to sand them evenly.
Oh, I see.
It was tricky. Okay, last thing on that, make sure you wet your sandpaper. It makes a huge difference.
Why no does it make sandpaper. A difference?
I think it's designed to do that way. I think if you read the instructions on your sandpaper, it would say get it wet first.
I do know that part, but I don't know why it's better. Like when I don't wet it, I feel like the disc turns out the same.
I don't know. Why does spaghetti get better when you boil it in hot water? It just is what it is.
Well, I don't chew the disc after I sand.
This is my son's fan tech update because he just reminded me of it. I was talking with my friend who has a virtual reality software company. So he's kind of much more in the know than I am about things that are happening in tech. And he was talking about how he has long conversations with ChatGPT with its voice system, which I tried today, and it is really crazy. You can have a full conversation with ChatGPT, and it's relatively natural. it sounds natural. It doesn't sound anything like Alexa or Google. It sounds like you're talking to, in the case of the voice I chose, Scarlett Johansson. And there's just a little bit of latency between you asking the question and it answering it. But anyways, he pointed out to me, or like we were talking about what we'd use it for, because he's really interested in like educational uses. And I was like, imagine taking your 3-year-old toddler who's nagging you and you're busy trying to work, and you just say, go talk to ChatGPT for the next 4 hours, and ChatGPT will answer all of your questions. So you can ask it, like, why does spaghetti get better when you boil it in water? And it will just keep answering your questions forever with probably mostly true things and then occasionally made up things that you'll carry with you the rest of your life as truth.
Same as humans then.
Same as humans. That's so true. Okay, let's move on to our next question. I know we've talked about this before, but hopefully we hit some new stuff there. So Larry wrote us. He said, I have so many comments and questions as I listen, and yet I think he only gave us like one or two questions. So his first question, which you didn't expect me to raise here, is, can you recommend a rookie Worlds partner that has some counter-brushing ability for any of the three divisions?
So I saw that and I'm like, ah, man, I am terrible because I don't have any recommendations. But
oh, you're so sad. I've got lots.
Okay. So my fault was, when I'm doing the house calls, I'm going to be like, why don't you come play with Larry Imperiali if you're on, like, someone on the fringe of going? I'll be like, I'll hook you up with a partner. Your counter, you got some brush skills.
That's true. That's probably one of the best ways to recruit people to the tournament. You should have the need partner list out super early and use that to gin up some interest in getting people to come to the event. Okay, but counter brushing ability, three divisions. Number one, mixed pairs, Zofia. I highly doubt she's available, but in terms of rookie, I think she's still a rookie by definition. She's probably only played for 3 years, 4 years, and certainly hasn't won a Worlds yet. So I'm going to counter. Andre Zaharias, more hard to say he's a rookie, but hasn't won a major, but he's a counter player. I don't know as much about his brushing, but I think he could handle it. Ray and Durham, lefty, natural lefty. He's a great counter brusher. He's as rookie gets. He's taken in co-op, though.
And he's playing with Will and Pierce, right?
Yes. And I've seen some of their routine, and people should be more scared than they are currently scared.
Okay.
So just brace yourself. When they showed me some of the co-ops they're working on, they were about 50 times more advanced than I thought they would be. So that was alarming. Otherwise, for rookie counter brushers, I may be out of options. Everyone else I can think of is much more senior. I mean, would you consider Daniel Weinbach? But I feel like now he's a breakout star.
Yeah. I think he's, yeah. I mean, he's still a good pick, but may not satisfy the rookie.
Yeah, I was trying to think of more left-handed players, because I think those are usually the best counter brushers, or at least they have the most natural counter brushing option.
There's also another condition that Larry has to leave before the finals. So I think that's why he wants a newer player, is so if they'll miss the cut kind of on by design.
Okay, well, that could be an incentive, right? Because you make it to the finals seeded first, and then you can't play. And then whoever wins has an asterisk on their title. Like 2012, Jake Gauthier and I won the semis and were seeded first in the finals. I don't know if we played last. Maybe we were probably second to last, but we were seeded as high as we could be. If only Jake had to leave that event and I could have told myself how we were going to win open pairs. I could like think of how history would have changed. So that's a positive. We're going to spin that. Okay. But Larry has a question that involves type 1 fun versus type 2 fun. And I think we've talked about this with slightly different vocabulary, but this seems to be lingo you're more familiar with. So why don't you explain what type 1 versus type 2 fun is?
So type 1 fun means you're having fun in the moment. It's kind of like eating ice cream with your friends. Like, it's enjoyable while you're doing it. And type 2 fun is enjoyable, but only after it's finished. So Larry's example is riding your bike up a big mountain. And when you get to the top, you're like, wow, that was fun. But while you were doing it, you're like, wow, this is painful.
Yes. So Larry's specific question, which I'm going to expand, is beach jamming, at least, well, he says, if beach jamming is type 1 fun, is working on a routine type 2 fun? So first, let's answer that. And then I think we should go through the different kinds of freestyle and talk about what type of fun they are at this point. So first, is working on a routine type 2 fun?
For me, it is type 1 fun, but I
knew you'd say
know
that.
You have a different answer than me.
Because yeah. So talk about that.
Okay. For me, I like the process and I like the problem solving. And it's kind of like building Legos to me. Building Legos could be type 2 fun for a lot of people, but it's easy to imagine playing with Legos to be type 1 fun. And it is. And that's what routine building feels like.
Is beach jamming type 1 or type 2 fun for you?
Well, certainly more than 5 years ago, it was type 1 fun. Now I think it's in type 2 territory.
Always, or it depends?
It's hard. I mean, on average, it's type 2, but sometimes it crosses over into type 1.
So think about your peak freestyle enthusiasm.
Yep.
Would basically any type of freestyle be type 1 fun?
Yes.
I agree completely. When do you think aspects started to become type 2 fun?
When they became repetitive. Actually, I don't even know if... Oh, yeah. Yeah, when it became repetitive, that's probably the biggest factor is like, I've done this before and I know what happened last time. And it doesn't take a lot of effort for me to do it again, but this is kind of all I can do.
Is there a year you could pin that
2014.
On? 2014. So early.
That's when it started. That's like, that's beach jamming was still fun in 2014.
Yeah. Huh. So if I was thinking beach jamming might be the last type 1 fun.
That's the holdout.
in freestyle for me. And I do think I've now better understand, because there are so many freestylers when I was younger who all they did and all they wanted to do was beach freestyle. And I just thought they were purists to the beach game or snooty about playing in less than ideal condition. I don't know. I had all these almost moralistic or ideological assumptions about that. But now I wonder if it's a natural path in freestyle. There's something about how the beach can stay fun, but the better you get, the more painful it is to play in other kinds of conditions. But I do think there's less type 1 fun available. I still think tournament jamming is generally type 1 fun for me. Mm-hmm. I think it's like the novelty,
it's more about the people than about the freestyle at that point.
Yeah, and I think it's about the people in a couple different ways. So one, you're jamming in a different way because you're being exposed to different variables because it's different groups of people that you don't play with as much. You're seeing new things that inspire you to try to play a little bit differently. You're hanging out with a different group of friends. That's novel and exciting. We don't get to see them that often. But I also think, at least for me, like Brendan teases me about this, but if someone walks by and starts watching us, I become a great freestyler again and start doing all this awesome stuff. And I'm like really fired up. And I feel that way a lot of times when I'm playing at a tournament, because most of those people don't see me play very much. And so I feel like I'm performing more again, versus there's something about, I feel like when I'm jamming a Duke, it's must be what it's like to be married for 80 years. I'm just sort of like, all right, like been here, done that. Like what else is new? Like it's just really hard for me to get excited. But I do think and I know this is all like kind of a sad topic that, you know, two people like you and me who are so obsessed with the freestyle having more trouble having fun with it. But I do think there are days and moments and situations where any kind of freestyle can become type one. I wish that happened more often, but it does happen. But here's an even darker question. Let's say there's a type three fun, which is it's not good during or after.
Okay.
Are there any aspects of freestyle that feel like type three?
Yeah. Just like you're, I think for you, it would be going out to Duke and just playing with the people you played with every day that year. That's what it is for me.
Yeah, I think for me, it's like that when I don't have energy to play well or play at all, frankly, which happens so much because of work too. So for instance, kind of like a good example of how this plays out for me happened this weekend. So I had a work conference this weekend. I got back Saturday. Will Ray and Paul Kenny were at my house because they're practicing for the routine. It's very frustrating that I had to go to a work conference. Paul Kenny was in town, but what can you do? And in theory, I should have energy. I didn't do anything that day except travel back from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And they were just finishing up. They wanted a jam. Paul wasn't going to jam. You know, it's Paul. He's old and creaky. And so I got my gear, got ready to play. And I just, my heart was not in it. It was type three fun. I don't even think I played more than like 45 minutes. And I was just like, I can't even do this anymore. And I tried every trick I knew to get fired up. And it's just got worse and worse and worse. But then the next day, but this kind of like, it was almost like a tournament situation. Paul Kenny wanted to play for a little bit just to say that he did it and to get him playing in the Spin Factory on video. And for the 30 minutes that he played, I had type one fun.
Nice.
Because I was like kind of showing off for Paul. Paul was showing me all these sets that I don't get from the Duke guys or frankly anybody else. So I was just having fun experimenting with that. And I wasn't necessarily like playing better. It was just fun again. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to like bottle that.
I think for me, it's depends a lot on purpose. So Last Catch is always type one fun for me. Is it type one fun for you?
No,
because there's a purpose to what's going on right now.
Well, I mean, one way to kind of pivot the conversation is to talk about like, what are the tricks to get fired up? Because I do think I try to create purpose in order, if not to create type one fun, to at least create type two fun. Because if you create some kind of goal, even if the jam is a difficult struggle, at the end of it, you can say, well, I worked on X and so I got something out of it. But I think sometimes creating a purpose for me backfires because my purpose is usually I create some challenge for myself. But then if I can't overcome that challenge, it's sort of like, so for instance, I guess I eventually got it because I realized I had my feet wrong. But, you know, I'm working on my lefty side, other spinning moves, and my lefty flamingitis seems to go in and out. And today it was out. And so I was trying to practice hitting the lefty flamingitis from like roll sets or on brush runs. And it's like, okay, I'm not really feeling like playing today. I had a really long day of work. Like I got up early, worked for like 10 or 11 hours straight and I couldn't hit it. And I just feel like it made it worse and worse. It's like, it didn't fire me up. And if you don't, like I hit it like once or twice eventually, but I don't even know if I hit it enough times that I like actually made progress, which kind of like sucks away the type two fun. Maybe I got worse at Frisbee today is like kind of what I'm getting at.
I see. That feels a little different than that was like, it's like the difference between what strategy and tactics. Like it's like you want your goal to be at the strategy level where you're like, so for me, type one fun, I can activate type one fun just by learning. So if any learning is involved, it's type one fun for me. Like I can be helping someone learn or someone can be helping me learn and it's great either direction. But like for me to get better at learning, I don't have to like catch 10 in a row for me to be learning. So if I'm like, this is only type one fun if I catch 10 in a row, it's gonna be bad. But like, that's not what it's dependent on. It's like, no, I'm learning. I'm not worried about catching 10 in a row, even though that's what I'm trying to do right now.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I do think my default way to be motivated the last few years, especially as this has become a bigger problem, is to stop trying to jam and start trying to learn, which is why I've talked about how I'm always self-conscious that the juke jammers are going to grow up and be like, you know, like James really wasn't very good, because like, I'm always just like, the juke freestylers have seen me do more foot tap combos than I ever care to admit, because that's just something I'm bad at and I'm working on.
You're going to like the mixed pairs commentary. There's a whole running joke we did the whole time where every time someone did the foot tap, I'm like, that's the hardest move in freestyle right there.
It's the hardest move. And I think for a long time that really served me well in terms of at least like keeping me motivated and giving me type two fun. But maybe I've lapped you in my freestyle cynicism, and that even learning has starting to reach its limits. Part of it is because we're so far past things that I'm actually deeply interested in learning, that it's like, not only am I not that interested in learning the things that I'm working on, but I'm kind of like, am I ever going to learn this? Like, is the rest of my life even enough time to learn whatever this thing is? Which is a cynical view. And I would say I'm not exaggerating. That's how I feel, even though I know intellectually that's wrong. Like, I still have a lot of time to learn things, and I have to remind myself that what I can do now took me 15 years to learn. I guess not quite 15, but like close to that. So it just takes a lot of time. But yeah, we have a lot of learning jam mode days. I wish I had more jam days, though. Like, I think, I can't remember if we talked about this in the last podcast or just I talked about this with you, but I used to just feel, there's like this kind of energy you feel when you're really fired up and you're having type one fun. And I think it relates to flow, but it's also something different to flow. It's like the energy you need to generate flow. And I used to have that energy every time I freestyled. Like, anytime I stepped out, I was trying to just conquer the world through freestyle. And like, I think about the times where I go to New York and it's like, Dougie, you're getting tired. Sit down. Give me another one. And I'm just like, give me more. Like, give me more people up here. I need someone there at 2 and someone there at 8 o'clock, because we're going to play for 8 hours and I'm tireless. And that is so rare now. Like, I'm always looking for that feeling of being energized, and it's so rare. And even at like Frisbeer, which we talked about with each other, if not at the podcast, like there were hours where I felt that energy, but half or more than half of the time I didn't have that energy, which that's pretty new for me to be at Frisbeer, this amazing event that I love with all these people I love, and not feeling like I have that energy. Granted, I also like clearly was deathly ill, but like I think in 2014 I could have had pneumonia and shingles and I would have been out there yeah, just like trying to hit quadruples. Like, I don't know, it just it's hard to know what to do. It's an existential crisis. And part of me is like, do I take a break, or will I take a break and come back feeling the exact same way? I just don't know what to do.
That's interesting. Like, I know what my plan is, but I don't know what your plan should be.
Well, what's your plan?
My plan is to transition, because I like the learning part, and I can find, oh, maybe I should advertise. Like, if you want to send me video of yourself, I will give you feedback every time. Like, we can do boot camps, anything. Like, it's so easy for me to find someone that's enthusiastic about learning that I can, like, I'm also enthusiastic about you learning. So it's easy for me to go that direction.
I think I have certainly enthusiasm and at least type two fun teaching other people that are enthusiastic. But I guess I'm struggling with how much I want to keep investing in my own freestyle development, which is a difficult question. I'm not ready to give it up yet, you know? And it's not like a ego thing of like, I want to stay on top or something. I retired.
It's a habit,
like,
that you don't want to break, it's like, yet. Well,
it's both a habit, and two, like, I don't want to, whatever, like, break both my legs at 45 and be like, oh man, like, I wish I had gotten more out of the years of my life where I was at like more or less peak physical condition. Now, like, obviously people can scoff at it, but like medically my body is already in decline from, you know, being a 22-year-old, but like, you know, I play so much with Paul and Toddy, and like you hear people say like what I would do to go back to when I was your age and play. And I don't want to waste that. Or like there's things that I can learn now that I'll be able to do when I'm 55, but I probably won't be able to learn when I'm 55. And so I don't really want to give that up, but habit's a big part of it, like you said. And I also think like I'm just bad at moderation. I think I've kind of unwittingly succeeded at moderation the last like 2 years, because any other person would have just quit playing. But like my absolute need to be all in at everything I do is butting forces with my absolute lack of motivation to freestyle. and like out of that, it's coming moderation. But like, I don't know. That's not like a good thing. It's just a fact. I don't know. This is a particularly therapeutic episode. If anyone has answers for these questions, I would love to know what people think. But like you said, you don't know what you think the answer is for me. Would you have any like hypotheses?
I don't. It's like, I think it should be, oh no. I think it's like there's a system, and what you are focusing right now is just like one part of all these bunch of different moving parts. And like one of the, like a big part of it that's not freestyle related is work. And
yeah,
I would focus on that problem by retiring at the same time I do.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking about it. You never know. There's another analogy I feel like that sort of applies to my current struggle with freestyle motivation. And I'm trying to build the like simplest version of this analogy, but here's like that. I can't think of a less like outlandish, like sci-fi analogy, but like you're on the Space Odyssey spaceship in interstellar space, and you've frozen 1,000 embryos that are going to wake up in like in a million years when you reach the next planet. But like, you're the last person who can like keep growing food and supplies for them when they wake up. And so like, you need to do everything you can to build up the needs so that when this future generation comes, it has what it needs. Like there's this part of me that's like, freestyle is lulling right now. Mm-hmm. And like I need to like build up as much information and knowledge as possible so that one day someone else can take it up, which maybe is like a overly inflated sense of my role in freestyle, but I think it's kind of like it's a story to tell myself to keep me motivated. And there's some tiny grain of truth in it. Like if nothing else, I think I have been learning lots of new things that Will is just immediately incorporating into his game. So it's like everything that I can come up with because I'm, you know, 12 years ahead of Will speeds up Will's progress. And one day that'll contribute to speeding up other people's progress.
I believe it. It's like the saying is standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, like I'm trying to grow into a bigger giant.
Yeah.
So there's more people that can stand on my shoulders. Yeah, I don't know. Something like that. Okay, but going back to this thing that I am interested in that I think is helpful to people, it's like ways to kind of get motivated in a gym. We talked about purpose, little games for yourself. We talked about learning, and these can be related, obviously. I also try to do kind of the 10 in a row, but also kind of like the Arthur horse game where it's like, okay, I'm just going to strip down to basics and just get a catch down, then do something maybe a little bit harder and just like kind of work my way up to get back to the point where I'm going big. Cause I think a lot of times when you're struggling, you go bigger and bigger, trying to just like slam your foot to the pedal, put on the gas, see if you can just shoot back into jam flow. But like usually that doesn't work.
What is the hero shot of freestyle?
Usually you just gotta play solid defense and just get back into the game one point at a time. So that's kind of my third strategy. Sometimes you gotta have a music change. Although I was thinking today about how for 10 years of my freestyle life, there was just no music and it never bothered me. Now I need music. That's how freestyle was so type one fun that I could be in the middle of a snowstorm with no music playing with an injured Dougie Fresh. And I was having the time of my life. Like, it just like didn't matter. Any other like suggestions for getting yourself motivated?
It's mine all revolve around having other people to interact with.
Yeah. That's interesting. I think also if you have the ability to mix up your jam personnel, it's great. Like try another jam, try to get different groups of people playing together to see if you can kind of get a little bit of a different energy for that day or that jam.
I would say that taking a break does work. Like the first jam after a month of not playing is much more type one fun.
Yeah. I would never know. I never take breaks, I guess. It's been so long. Oh, you know what? I do have this other theory that's kind of related to this that I wanted to run by you. So a bunch of people have recommended this book to me, and I'm kind of loath to even mention it because it sounds like something that it isn't. But there's this book called Outlive by Peter Attia, I think is his name. I might have to check that while I'm talking. And it's a book by this doctor, Peter Attia. And in the kind of the best terms, it's about extending your health span, which is not necessarily your lifespan, like how many years you live, but how many years you live healthfully, where you're kind of doing the things that you want to be able to do. And the reason I'm loath to bring up a book like this, it sounds like some kind of fad diet, you know, cheesy, popular, like get healthy quick books. It's not that at all. It talks a lot about kind of like cancer drug research and, you know, like immunotherapy and just like kind of like things that are changing in medicine that are really interesting. But then like the few things we know about having a like better life. And so many people have recommended this book to me from different sources, but what really got me interested in it was the research on the Wegovy Ozempic type drugs that help people lose weight really effectively. But those drugs also cause like muscle loss. And all these people kept talking about how like muscle loss is a really big problem and citing to this Outlive book that talks a lot about like the importance of how much muscle you have like throughout your life. But anyways, this book talked a lot about building up your stabilizing muscles, which as you can imagine is super important when you're like 70 and 80, because those are the muscles that prevent you from falling and whatnot. And there's all these like really weird like measures that can tell you someone's like probability of living the next 10 years. And like one of like the number one predictor is like grip strength. And they don't totally know why, but like one reason is if you're falling and you can grab the rail next to you or the chair and like hold yourself up, like you're less likely to die. But like it's like really kind of like intuitive once you think about them, but unintuitive just as a general principle. You wouldn't go around being like, you're 75, here's what you need to do. Hit these stress balls like an hour a day. It's gonna add 6 years to your life. But anyway, so like I was reading about that and I was thinking about how like I felt really off balance like the last couple of years. And I was thinking about how 2019, I didn't actually have like the highest level of skill. Like I think I have more skill now than I did then in like a pure freestyle sense. But I think I played a lot better then than I'm playing now. And my theory, and maybe I'm pushing a square peg in a round hole, is that that's year I broke my collarbone and had like 8 weeks of physical therapy. And my physical therapy was like full body, like building my balance up. And I remember at the time I would spend a lot of time just like standing in a flamingo position and holding it for a minute, or like lifting my leg up in front of my body, like a leg over a Rockhead singer, and like holding that for a minute. And I tried doing some of those things now and I was really struggling. So I think I need to kind of rebuild my balance, because I do wonder if like part of why I'm less motivated is I think it must be hard for anybody to start losing skill. You know what I mean? Like, if you're trying to do your peak and it's not happening, it's really deflating. And so I'm like, but it also presents a conundrum. Like, what's, how do I get out of not playing very well? I have to play even better. Like, I don't know. It's like kind of hard, but I'm trying to get myself motivated to start like lifting weights and working out and like really working on my balance and like kind of like strength training for freestyle. Like, I've always said that my wrist strength has made a huge difference to throwing. So it wouldn't surprise me if that extends to everything else. Like, if I have really good balance, like I, for instance, I notice, I think if you chart it out, like what proportion of my catches are flamingitis, flamingo versus scarecrow. I think in like 2019, I'm just making numbers up for comparison's sake, maybe half of my catches were like flamingo, flamingitis, balance catches, lower body, and like half were scarecrow behind the head, upper body. But now I'm like 95% upper body, because I think like unconsciously I don't want to bend down and try to hold that position because it's harder for me to do now. And so I have to kind of like rebuild that strength. But like one thing he talks a lot about in the Outlet book is if you want to kind of continue the lifestyle you have to be elite for your age group and average for like kind of the decade before. So like if you're a 30-year-old, you want to be as fit as an average 20-year-old. If you're a 40-year-old, you want to be as fit as an average 30-year-old. So like the good news is I did basically nothing in my 20s to be fitter, better, faster, stronger. So hopefully like a minimum level of effort in my 30s will make me feel like I did in my 20s. And, you know, we'll reconvene at 40 and 50. Yeah.
It's, I don't know, we're like talking about motivation. Like, why do you even want to be, or like, why do you even want to do those balance exercises to be better?
Well, look, that is such a depressing question that I've been afraid to frame it on this podcast. But I definitely, more so than I've ever had in my life, have these why freestyle questions now, where I think I have spent, and to be clear, I have zero regrets about the time I put into freestyle. It's been among, if not the most rewarding activity that I've ever engaged in. But looking forward, I do ask myself, do I want to spend the next 10 years focused on freestyle? Because what will I get from it? Maybe I don't get significantly better. That's not very growth mindset of me to say, but you know, basketball players that are 40 are not as good as they were when they were 30, even though they practice an additional 10 years. There's a lot of different factors that go into that. But like, I do think freestyle has a later and longer time horizon. But I asked myself that. I asked myself kind of like, who's still interested anymore? Like, it's hard not to see that, you know, like I said, I looked at all the YouTube videos from the last 3 months. Maybe there's 15 freestyle frizzy videos that have been posted. Granted, some people are posting on Instagram and TikTok and other places that I'm not privy to, but it feels like I'm trying to perfect what is essentially a performance art that less and less people are performing or interested in. And that's a struggle. But what else? You know, I don't know. Like, I don't really know what else I would do. And getting back a little bit more to your specific question, no matter how you cut it, freestyle is just unequivocally good for me to do. Like, even if I don't like doing it sometimes, it's exercise, it's social, it's outside, it's creative. And so I could be like other 30-year-olds who are doing a good job and like going to a miserable gym every day and hating every second of it, to try to be healthier and be like we're supposed to be as humans. Or I could freestyle, and maybe I'm less motivated to freestyle than I used to be, and I don't like it sometimes. But if it becomes just like going to the gym, then I'm kind of a step ahead. But on the balance thing, you could argue that sometimes I'm more motivated to do that than freestyle. But it's almost like a diminishing return idea. Like, I can see immediate gains in strength training that I won't see in freestyle.
That part, and newbie gains.
Yeah, and I know intellectually that it's unequivocally good for me. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I never freestyle again, I probably should still be strength training because it'll enable me to live a healthier life.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
But I'm always worried about saying this stuff because I don't want to just like bum anyone else out and discourage them from freestyling. I mean, I do think everyone needs to make peace with the size of freestyle. And I made that peace a really long time ago. I'm sure I've told this story before, but Katarzyna Pleskotova in the Czech Republic, like one day I was blithering on about how I wanted to grow freestyle so big. And she was like, why do you even want that? And like, I never like really thought about it. She was like, it's cool as it is. Like, just enjoy it. And I was like, okay, like, of course I want to grow the sport. And I think that's a noble goal. But I think you should always do that with some degree of peace about what it is and the comfort with that. So I don't want any of my like lack of motivation or like cynicism about this to prevent anyone from pursuing this sport. You know, we wouldn't be making a podcast, and like I still jam like almost every day. So it's still super important to me, but I have peace with how it is. I think I even have peace if the sport kind of, I don't think it'll ever die out, but like if it transformed in some way that was very foreign to how it is now, like if there weren't any tournaments or whatever, like if there wasn't Worlds one year, I don't think I would be like devastated by that. But it's definitely going to be an interesting time for freestyle.
Mm-hmm. Man,
do you ever like worry about, I don't know, either demotivating people from joining, or almost the opposite, do you worry about introducing someone to a love that may be unrequited?
No. For the two different cases, like one, the sport is small enough that I'm like, I can do everything myself. So if I care, yeah, I'll run Worlds every year.
Yeah.
And like bringing people in, I don't know, I feel like it's like a religion. Like I don't really care about all the bad stuff we do. It's just like more the merrier.
I actually really like that analogy, but I tell the Duke guys, no matter what, you have to, or I don't know, this is maybe like a more extreme view than I actually think, but it's something like, you need to do this because it's fun to play Frisbee with your friends. And if there's a tournament scene and world championships and an international community in addition, then awesome. But you should do this because it's super fun to jam with your buddies, especially on the beach when the conditions are good. Okay. Anything else on that? I went way too personal on this podcast. Apologies.
I don't think so.
But whatever. Yeah. You know,
that's what people people are.
There's only like 20 people listening. So we should be, if the world is going to end, if freestyle is going to end, I'm going to go out my way. Yep. The Frank Sinatra my way. Like, we're doing it. This is us.
Yep. We're still going to do the Paul Kenny idea where we just say all the things we don't like about each other.
Oh, yeah. Did we talk about that? He was telling me about that while he was here. Yeah, that could be interesting. All right. No, we have things we need to do. All right. I have not a great question from Timek that we're going to put off to another podcast because it's got so much content to do. Okay. But with that, write us at clockerconnor@gmail.com. We do get emails sometimes. We really appreciate it. If you're listening, just send us an email. Just say hi. Keep us motivated. Send Ryan videos of you jamming and send them to me too. And we'll tell you what we think if that's what you want, or we'll just watch them to support you. I'll put a shout out real quick to Ollie, who posted a video called The Work, which I watched today, which is him trying over and over and over again a couple combos and mostly messing them up until he finally gets it. And you can hear him like cursing and screaming and getting mad at himself. And I was like, yes, this is awesome. This is The Work. This is what it's like. We're out there. We're doing it. So you send me your video, I will watch it. So cool. With that, we'll talk to you next month.